warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
The spotlight.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kavit Afwai. The second meeting of the foreign ministers of Afghanistan's neighboring countries plus Russia have wrapped up in the Iranian capital, Tehran. The joint statement called for avoiding foreign interference in Afghanistan's internal affairs, need for an all-inclusive government. Will this help solve Afghanistan's problems? Will the Taliban use the outcomes of this meeting and listen to calls by its neighbors, especially Iran? In this edition of The Spotlight, the results of the one-day Afghanistan conference will be discussed and the destructive role that the U.S. played and may play in that country.
It's the first solid step by Afghanistan's neighbors to help restore peace to the war-torn country. The Tehran summit brought together foreign ministers of Iran, China, Pakistan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and Turkmenistan, plus Russia, to help form an inclusive government and establish peace and stability in Afghanistan after the United States pull out and the Taliban's take over. As the host, Iran blamed the Afghan crisis on foreign intervention while renewing its call for the establishment of an inclusive government in Afghanistan.
The crisis worrying all of us today is the result of unwarranted interference by oppressive powers, specifically the U.S. occupation of and intervention in Afghanistan and West Asia over the 2 decades. 20 years ago, the U.S. invaded Afghanistan under the pretext of fighting terrorism and escalated instability, war, poverty, and displacement there with its continued military presence.
The Taliban announced an interim government in Afghanistan in September, weeks after it took control of the country amid swift advances on the ground, following a hasty withdrawal of U.S.-led foreign forces after 2 decades of presence on the Afghan soil. In a recorded message to the conference, U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres thanked Iran for initiating the conference and called on all regional countries to join hands to tackle the problems in Afghanistan.
We can only achieve more stability with a united approach. Together, let us act with determination and without delay to help the people of Afghanistan and to secure a better future for all.
A similar message was echoed by the Chinese and Russian foreign ministers who attended the meeting via video conference.
Not only do we need to encourage the new Afghan authority to make a clean break with terrorist forces, we also need to support it in independently, resolutely, and effectively combating all extremist and terrorist organizations, including ISIL and the ETIM. We need to positively consider holding bilateral and multilateral counterterrorism dialogues and cooperation with Afghanistan.
We call on Afghanistan's neighboring countries not to allow a military presence of U.S. and NATO forces that plan to move there after leaving Afghanistan's territory.
Tehran's meeting followed another summit held virtually in September, where the foreign ministers of Afghanistan's neighboring states agreed to collaborate with the Afghan government to build the future of Afghanistan based on the will of the Afghan nation. Now, a third round of talks is expected to be hosted in China.
Delegates at Tehran conference say the ultimate way out of the crisis is for the Afghan leadership to form an inclusive government that reflects the interests of all ethno-political parties in Afghanistan. At the same time, they express their readiness to help Afghanistan get off the ground after years of conflict, while respecting the country's sovereignty self-determination, and territorial integrity. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Well, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the debate. We have Saeed Muaz Shah, who is a lawyer, geopolitical analyst, and director of the Center for Human Rights at Ziauddin University, joining us from Karachi. Also joining us, Elijah Magnier, who's a journalist and political analyst, joining us from Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Saeed Muaz Shah, I'm going to first start with you and ask you what you think about the fact that Iran actually was the host and took the initiative for having this one-day conference to obviously discuss with Afghanistan's neighbors, plus Russia, some important challenges and solutions for the country.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here, and that's such an important question about Iran's role. And I think that's something that shows regional leadership from Iran. We're in a situation in Afghanistan, you have a lot of people in the international community talking about different solutions, but not very many people are actually actively involved and actually working constructively on that. There's a lot of criticism to the regime there. But as we can see, of course, with the recent reports with the World Food Program situation, and the United Nations' latest reports about the humanitarian crisis that's developing there, not to mention ISIS rearing its head as well in a different form in ISIS of Khorasan, we see that, you know, Afghanistan at this time period needs the help and attention. And for Iran to call all the local regional members to come together and for all of them to show up, even China and Russia through digitally, this clearly shows that there, you know, the world has not really focused in on this. And it's the regional players that have to step up, because whatever happens in Afghanistan affects the neighboring countries. So I think it was a very important role. I think it was a very constructive role, because I think this is an indication of this summit about who and what countries will be the first to recognize this government. Because I think that's really where the discussion starts at. And until we have an official recognition of the government, it is very difficult to deal and lend support. So I believe this summit is a primer for that conversation in the international community, and a lot of countries are relying on each other to build that confidence to support them, particularly in handling this ISIS situation. So I'm really happy that Iran has taken this lead, has invited regional countries and players that are all affected with this crisis that's unfolding in Afghanistan. And essentially, they're lending words of support and encouraging that the Afghanistan government and the people who are there, the Taliban, you know, don't feel like they are being pressured into a corner where they have no support. And I think that's something we want to avoid. We see a lot of these overtures. We see a lot of the language coming from the Taliban from the beginning, and even before they took over Kabul, that they're open to the international community and the international community and its norms and regulations, and they're going to make efforts for that. We see they are trying. Obviously, with limited resources, we can only expect so much. So at the same time, there has to be an extension of hand and help, and I think this summit kind of pushes that conversation.
Okay, so let's, Elijah Magnier, look at what translated into a joint communique that was then announced. And one of the things that stands out, because it has been repeated so often, especially by Iran, and that is the fact that there's a need for the establishment of what they call all-inclusive governments, a government with the participation of all Afghan ethnicities. Why is that important?
Thank you for having me. It is important because Taliban did not announce the formation of a government, but a temporary government. Therefore, it is not possible to deal with the state or to recognize Afghanistan with a sovereign state and with a functional government unless we have all the parties and all the different ethnic groups participating to this government, and it is a final government approved by the population and by all parties who were involved in fighting the U.S. forces and who have the right to share the power in Afghanistan. And that is important because that gives the idea of all the surrounding country that the Taliban is not going to try or is not excluding any groups in Afghanistan and want a national government where everybody will participate so the international community and the neighboring country can deal with it on fair ground. Afghanistan is in need of a lot of support. The international community and the surrounding countries around Afghanistan wants to know if the Taliban movement is going to take Afghanistan to the level of a state and no longer just a movement who fought against the U.S. invasion for 20 years and is going beyond being a normal movement that is not trying to build the state, because Afghanistan needs so much support on a humanitarian level, but first of all, its relationship with its neighboring country and with the international community comes on a first step as a first priority. And also, there is a need for all the neighboring countries to understand if this government is going to stop terrorism inside Afghanistan and prevent terrorism from crossing the borders and create havoc in neighboring country. And that is what everybody is looking for today, acting simultaneously with the humanitarian aid that is much needed in Afghanistan.
Sure, the problems are multifaceted, multifold in terms of the different ways that it needs to be tackled. But I'm guessing, Sayyid Omar Shah, that stability needs to be maintained. And that brings me to a statement that Iran's president has said, Ebrahim Raisi, that terrorist incidents are hurting every human being, and Afghanistan is no exception. And he said there's no doubt that the Americans are involved in such incidents and do not want the Afghan people to achieve peace and security. Is the U.S. responsible, either indirectly, directly, or covertly, when it comes to the Daesh terrorists by the name of Khorasan, I believe, that are operating in that country, or just terrorists in general, and what would be their gain if that is so?
Well, I think this question has already kind of been proven by a lot of investigative journalists who've researched this group when it poked its head. We know Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi was in a camp that the U.S. controlled, and they were the ones that kind of that was like a training area, and obviously developed resources and contacts there. We also know there are pictures of senators who have met Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi in Syria. So, I mean, I don't know what more clear proof that needs to be said, if not the collapse of Mosul and the collapse of the capital in Syria, of Raqqa. We know that there was thousands that were giving negotiated passage in buses. Where did it all go? And surprisingly, some of them are popping their heads up in Afghanistan during the U.S. occupation at the time. There is a connection that you can see the thread that's being connected, and I don't think that's unreasonable for anybody to assume. And obviously, the United States being upset after 20 years of a failed project, they want to now lay the blame. Oh, okay, we weren't able to do anything, and these people who essentially were their enemies and their combatants against them, the Taliban, we're going to make sure that they're not able to do something too. This is clearly what I'm looking at. But I want to go back about this comment by the from the Iranian side about inclusiveness. And I think the Taliban have been very indicative of that. We began to see that there were Hazara commanders in their ranks, Tajik commanders in their ranks, Sure, in the current temporary structure, they have not been able to do that. But I want to remind everybody who's watching here, when the United States came to Afghanistan in 2001, it wasn't until 2004 when a constitution and the Loya Jirga was actually called on. Even then, I wouldn't call it very inclusive. So it took them 3 years to stabilize the situation. It hasn't been 3 months, and we're expecting the Taliban, with much less resources, much less capabilities, to do the same thing. And I think it's a little bit ridiculous for anybody in the international community to constantly insist this thing. When we see the sheer difference of the Taliban takeover in the 90s to what they did a few months ago, there is a clear difference of the narrative that they're trying to build, they're trying to actually progressively work towards, and everybody who really is in the back doors appreciates that internationally, that Taliban is clearly different from what it was. It's a Taliban 2.0. And I think it's time that in the international community, they need to start extending further help to kind of ensure that. And I can promise you this, that those countries who will recognize this government first will probably have the more deeper influences in influencing it positively. Now, the less the international community keeps its doors closed, the Taliban's extremist factions will be kind of have an upper hand. And we do not want to see that. We see a similar situation if we go back to 2006 in Somalia, when the Islamic Courts Union, first time were able to bring a peace in a country that was ravaged by civil war for 15 years. What did the United States and the Western governments decide to do? They decided to fund and support Ethiopia to invade this fledgling new government there. And there was nothing there. There was this whole thing. And what ended up happening? Al-Shabaab, which was a small wing within the Islamic Courts Union, reared his head and said, see, we told you so. Now we're going to take the more extremist action.
Right.
And we're sitting here today, 15 years later, in the position when Al-Shabaab is a major terrorist organization operating. And if we only had kind of lent some support to a more inclusive, more open government, it's Islamic, okay? There's nothing wrong with that. I think that's a right of the Afghanistan people. Even
of
when
course.
The Islamic Republic of Afghanistan considered themselves Islamic, I don't think that's something that, you know, we should shy away from. And this narrative that, you know, somehow anyone who's associated with an Islamic or kind of tinge, we have to be fearful
Indeed.
For. And that's something unfortunate. And, you know, Iran is an Islamic Republic itself.
Sure.
So that's something that I think that we need to be really consciously supportive in a way that, you know, it's kind of like if we give some support internationally, what can we expect from them? But don't just expect something from someone with limited resources and trying to have them do the same thing.
Well, that's the whole point there, Elijah Magnier, that Afghanistan, now that the Taliban is in power there, needs to have the respect that it needs and needs to get that international respect. One of the things that this one-day conference brought about is the fact that there needs to the country needs to not be have its sovereignty violated. There should be no outside influence. And yet, I'm looking at this particular New York Times article that says American officials are reworking plans to counter threats that could emerge from Afghanistan's chaos. According to former officials and current ones, which includes, and this is the part that I'd like to get your reaction on, negotiating for new bases in Central Asian countries in order to run operations like, let's say, drone strikes. The CIA obviously involved in this. So are we looking at the fact that this is already in the works, if not established by the U.S., as it states here, with Central Asian countries?
It is inevitable for the U.S. to remain in the area because this is how the empire works. And we've seen that in different parts of West Asia. We see how many U.S. bases are spread in Europe. And the Americans, under the pretext of fighting terrorism, they also always find a way to remain in the country or to remain nearby and violate the sovereignty of this or that country. And we heard President Biden, even before the withdrawal, saying, even if we pull out from Afghanistan, we will always maintain a counterterrorism support or a base in the country or in the nearby countries. That means there are more than 35 military bases around Iran. There are dozens of other military U.S. military bases in the area, and the U.S. Is known to violate the sovereignty of any country under this pretext, and this is what's happening in Syria, this is what's happening in Iraq, and in other parts of the Middle East and in sovereign countries. So what the Americans are saying here, under the pretext of ISIS Khorasan, that were operating when the U.S. Forces were occupying Afghanistan, the U.S. will return to operate in Afghanistan again with or without the support of the Afghan government, because Afghanistan is in need of international support and can't stand to the U.S. and say to the U.S., you cannot violate our sovereignty. So the U.S. will always find a reason to force itself on other states, unless there is a country like the Islamic Republic of Iran saying, if you violate our sovereignty, we will shoot down your drones or your aircraft, or we will respond to against your bases that are nearby, like it happened in Ain al-Assad in Iraq. I don't think Afghanistan is in this position today, and Afghanistan needs to work very hard to build its military capability with the support of nearby country to be able to stand against the U.S., not to fight the U.S., but to prevent the U.S. from violating its sovereignty.
Okay, we're drawing down on this program in terms of time. So, Sayyid Mu'ashara, let me ask you, based on what we've discussed and based on what transpired in this one-day conference, solutions that were put forward, sounds great on paper, but do you think it's going to translate in and materialize into action based on the proposals? Will the Taliban heed, for example, to work towards that all-inclusive governments? How do you see these things happening?
You know, I think we have to take a balancing approach to this, and the countries, especially the neighboring countries of Afghanistan, need to realize what my colleague just spoke about, was that, you know, the United States used this as a pretext. And obviously, we've seen the United States be here for 20 years in this region, and clearly the pretext, and there's specific examples of, you know, the drones flying over Iran, and Iran successfully took down a drone that was flying in their airspace when they were in Afghanistan. And so, you know, this clearly shows that, you know, not to provide the pretext, but now the pretext is being created if the regional players don't come in and support. If you remember in 2005, the Manas Air Base was shut down because the Russians clearly realized that this is, the Americans are not just here for this operation in Afghanistan, but they're involved in other sorts of activities. And the concern of China as well, if you think about it, and I think this is the bigger context of this discussion and paradigm, they would not like an air base of the United States on their Western Front. And unfortunately, that's something that, you know, this is a collective interest of all countries in the region to lend further support and not provide the pretext. So I guess it starts with, if we want to work on counterterrorism, on ISIS, it's got to be on a regional level. And I think that's something Iran definitely mentioned within this context of this summit. It's in the interest of Russia, and we know the situation in China as well, and Pakistan, to come together on this issue and lend support to the Taliban and the government. But again, I have to emphasize this enough. They have to get some sort of recognition. They have to get some sort of aid. The $9 billion that has been frozen of the Afghanistan people by the United States is the most deplorable act the United States could have done on its exit. They need that money to create an environment in Afghanistan that does not breed extremism. So this is going to be counterproductive if we're just going to sit here saying, oh, you haven't delivered. This is the same thing the Israelis used against Yasser Arafat and the Palestinian people. Oh, you're not able to control terror, so we won't give you anything. Okay. And that created a cycle of violence. So I think this is a positive thing. I do hope that from the summit we see some action. And I'll be very frank with you. I think the regional players here will be the first to recognize this government and lend their support. And they desperately need it. I just hope it's not very late. That's my main concern.
Very well. Thank you very much for that. Sayyid Mu'ashara, lawyer, geopolitical analyst, and director of the Center for Human Rights at Ziauddin University for Karachi. Thank you for your comments. And thank you, Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst from Brussels. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. From Mika Vitafa, the entire team, it's goodbye until next time. We'll be right back.
But beside being a work regarding glossaries of the Holy Quran, the main important point regarding At-Tahqiq fi Kalamat al-Quran al-Karim is that author has some, you know, basic rules in his mind, and he is trying to use these rules to deliver a book to the people, to the researchers, in a way that they may get use from this book and to find a new outstanding meaning of the Holy Quran.
And why you are enjoying reading that book? Because it gives you this sense of freedom that you also, as a reader, you have this sense of ijtihad and expertise to go through different books, make a comparison, and then come to your point.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. The teacher is about the lives and works of the most outstanding Shiite scholars, thinkers, jurists, and philosophers all across the world of Islam. And with me in the studio for today's discussion are Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyani. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So for today's discussion, we want to talk about the most outstanding work of Allama Mirza Hasan Mustafavi, known as At-Tahqiq fi Kalamat al-Quran al-Karim. You know, we can roughly translate this title into English as a research on the lexicon or lexemes or the words of the Holy Quran. Sheikh Ziyani, let's start with you, brother. It seems that Allama Mustafavi dedicated his life to this work, and you know, in 14 volumes, you know, he compiled this book, At-Tahqiq fi Kalamat al-Quran al-Karim. First of all, give us an introduction to this book and what was the need, I mean, to compile such a book.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allama Mustafavi rahmatullah alayhi has compiled this book, At-Tahqiq fi Kalamat al-Quran al-Karim, in 14 volumes, and this book is a glossary of the words of the Holy Quran. And you know, every person who wants to search about Holy Quran regarding, for example, tafsir, I mean jurisprudence, or trying to get some meanings of the Quran, I mean trying to get some, you know, teachings from Quranic verses, he needs the book At-Tahqiq fi Kalamat al-Quran al-Karim. Because, you know, there are some words in each verse or in each, you know, chapter that we need to get, you know, more familiar with the concepts of these words and to understand them correctly.
That's right.
And that's why Allama Mustafavi rahmatullah alayhi decides to, you know, compile this book. Of course, we had, you know, dictionaries in Arabic language that gives the definitions of the words and the origins of the words. But, you know, At-Tahqiq fi Kalamat al-Quran al-Karim is a book that, first of all, is dedicated for Quranic words.
Yes.
Of course, we had some other works in regarding this. Mm-hmm. For example, we have Mufradat Lirraghib al-Isfahani also.
Yes.
But Mufradat is not as vast as At-Tahqiq fi Kalamat al-Quran al-Karim. But beside being, you know, being a work regarding glossaries of the Holy Quran, the main important point regarding At-Tahqiq fi Kalamat al-Quran al-Karim is that the author has some, you know, basic rules in his mind.
That's right.
And he is trying to use these rules to deliver a book to his audience, to the people, to the researchers, in a way that they may get use from this book and to find a new outstanding meaning of the Holy Quran.
That's right.
So from this point of view,
yes,
the book of At-Tahqiq fi Kalamat al-Quran al-Karim is a noble work.
Yes.
That, in my opinion, every researcher regarding Holy Quran studies has to refer to this book.
Is this written in Persian or in Arabic?
No, the book is in Arabic.
It's Arabic.
Yes.
So when he's explaining the words of the Holy Quran, the explanation is again in Arabic, is it?
Yes.
Okay.
So, you know, for example, he gives the origins, you know, of each, you know, word.
Yes.
For example, the word yazrebo.
Yes.
He brings it to its root, that is zaraba.
Yes.
And then he goes to the origin of this word.
Oh.
He gives some, you know, definitions from different
right,
dictionaries.
Yes.
And then after giving different ideas, he says, "But tahqiq fi hadhihi al-lugha is this."
Yes.
The correct understanding and the correct meaning of this word is as continues.
Yes, very good.
So this book is, you know, a very, very prominent work for
a precious, really a precious research, especially not only for the researchers, but I think for all the Muslims who want to be more familiar with the language of the Holy Quran, which is Arabic, and their mother tongue is not Arabic language, but I think the writing style is simple and simple to understand.
Yes.
What is done by Allama Mustafavi. Okay, Sheikh Mahtavi, what is the main research methodology of Allama Mustafavi in this book? I mean, where does he start from and where does he end?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. With respect to the methodology of Allama Mustafavi regarding compiling this very profound dictionary on the words of Quran, this is really important to know that when you open At-Tahqiq, you really enjoy reading At-Tahqiq. Why? Because you feel that it's kind of freedom, sense of freedom. The author of the book is inspiring. Why? Because first of all, he tried to quote from different dictionaries. For example, he's saying that, okay, in At-Tahdhib, he has said this. Misbah Fayumi has mentioned another thing. Al-Ain believes on this, and what Tahqiq, what I am saying right now. Why you are enjoying? Why? Because you don't need to go and refer on all individual books that he's quoting from. You have all dictionaries at your hand.
That's right.
So you can get the meaning through all of them. And then you can realize when you read, he is mentioning some different points regarding wal aslu. This wal asl, because of the principle that he believes in. He believes that all derivatives from the same root must come back to the same meaning.
Okay.
So through the years, through the history, out of going through different environments, this word and root may experience or go through different cultures and end up in different application. But what Allama Mustafavi is trying to show us is this, that, okay, when you see Fayumi has mentioned this meaning for this derivative, another author or another exegete has mentioned another meaning. He say wal aslu hadha. This wal aslu hadha, he's trying to bring it back to the meaning he believes in.
You mean to the original meaning of the same word? Or no, the original meaning of the same word in the environment at the time of revelation of the Holy Quran.
Different application of the word that happened.
Okay.
Different application of the word which happened in different contexts.
Yes. Okay.
And also it is correct when they use it.
Yes.
But when you look at it, you see, for example, the word Ayn, there are 70 application and 70 meaning mentioned in the dictionaries for the word Al-Ayn.
That's right.
Okay? So what he does is to take it back to the same meaning, saying that all these, for example, 10 application and 10 usages of this derivative must come back to this root that I'm telling you.
That's right.
And why you are enjoying reading that book? Because it gives you this sense of freedom that you also, as a reader, you have this sense of ijtihad and expertise to go through different books, make a comparison, and then come to your point.
That's all right.
It's a kind of ijtihadi methodology of coming up with the true meaning of the words of Quran.
Very good. Thank you very much, Sheikh Mahtavi. Sheikh Ziyaniya, so it makes an exception, especially the research style and the research methodology of Allama Mustafavi.
Yes. You know, regarding the point that the words in Arabic are going back to, you know, to a single, you know, origin, we have other books also. For example, we have Mujam Maqais al-Lugha from Ibn Faris, that he also is trying to have this approach. But regarding the Holy Quran, the only book is At-Tahqiq fi Kalamat al-Quran al-Karim. Besides that, you know, At-Tahqiq is a book that, because it has an ijtihadi approach, so it gives you this, you know, chance to evaluate your understanding also.
Yes, very good.
This is also another, you know, good point regarding this book. And I should mention this, you know, point that some people, because Allama Mustafavi in the introduction of At-Tahqiq, he mentions some, you know, basic rules, amongst which is that his words is giving this picture that maybe he is not believing in metaphor in the Holy Quran. But this is not the way of the idea of Allama Mustafavi rahmatullah alayhi, because when we come to At-Tahqiq fi Kalamat al-Quran al-Karim, we find in some, you know, points of the book that he mentions that this, for example, this is the original meaning of the word, but in the verse it is used as metaphor.
A metaphor, you know, figurative language might be, okay?
Yes.
That's right, okay.
So the point is that Allah Mustafavi is saying that we are not allowed to get the exact meaning of the words from Arabic poems.
Mm-hmm.
Quran itself is a resource, that's is right. a source
yes.
for getting the meaning of the words.
Okay.
So because some, you know, scholars, linguists, they try to get the meanings of the words from, you know, Arabic poems.
Yes.
And sometimes Allah Mustafavi says, okay, these poems also may have metaphor. Okay. So why are you, you know, putting Quranic verses on these poems?
Yes. Compare it with the poetic book.
It is not That's correct. Right. Okay. So he says, if you want, if you have some doubts, not if you are sure that this word is a metaphor in Quran, If you have some doubts regarding the meaning of the word, you are not allowed to compare this word with poems to say that, okay, now in the poem it is used like this.
That's right.
So in Quran it is metaphor.
Okay. Sheikh Mahtavi, is it alphabetic? I mean, we can refer it to as a dictionary. I mean, is it alphabetic?
Actually, that is based on Mu'jam al-Mufahras.
Okay.
The way that Mu'jam al-Mufahras has...
And Mu'jam is a very famous book in most of the libraries.
Mu'jam al-Mufahras, yes. That is to look up the words.
Okay.
By the root and by the... Actually, by the root of the words, you can find out and you can look up the verses of the Quran.
Yes.
So, as it is mentioned in the introduction of the book, this voluminous book has been... compiled based on Al-Mu'jam al-Mufahras. So the order is following the order of Mu'jam al-Mufahras.
That's right. So the main routes are over there in the madkhals or the entries, and then everybody goes there, and different derivatives and interpretations of the words are over there.
Sure.
So it would be very useful for the Quranic researchers, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure.
And also for the public. Can the public use that?
Yeah, definitely. Recently, they have published this book in alphabetic order, which is really user-friendly, and even public, they can benefit from this book.
That's right. Yeah. Thank you very much. Anything missed about At-Tahqiq fi Kalimat al-Quran al-Kareem?
To have conclusion regarding At-Tahqiq fi Kalimat al-Quran al-Kareem, we may say that because this book has written recently and is a new one, so it has used the experiences of the scholars, old ones, the, you know, people who has dedicated their lives in linguistic language. So because it's a new book, we may introduce it as a book that is necessary for every person
right.
that wants to work in this field.
Usually the books and the references on the Quranic studies dates back to centuries before, but this is really a chance for all the people to be familiar with the modern scholar talking about the words in the Holy Quran. Also Tafsir al-Roshan, or the Vikasa Roshan exegesis of the Holy Quran, which is compiled by this man, Amin Allah Mustafavi, in the Persian language, is also very much welcomed among the Persian-speaking ones. Okay, thank you very much. May Allah bless the soul of the late Allama Mustafavi, Mirza Hasan Mustafavi, the compiler and the author of the precious book in 14 volumes, At-Tahqiq fi Kalamat al-Quran al-Kareem. I really invite all of our dear listeners who are interested in the Holy Quran and its words and the glossaries to refer to this outstanding reference, a book which has been compiled by a Shia scholar, Allama Mustafavi. Sheikh Ziyanian, Sheikh Mahtavi, thank you very much for your presence in the program, The Teacher.
You are most welcome.
You are most welcome. Thank you.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of The Teacher on the life and work of Allama Mirza Hasan Mustafavi. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanullah.
Had a teacher, the teacher of teachers. He changed the world for the better and made us better creatures. Oh Allah, we've shamed ourselves, we've strayed from Al-Mu'allim. Surely we've wronged ourselves, what will we say in front of them?
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puriza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
President of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashat, has sent a stern message to the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, slamming the world body's inaction regarding Saudi Arabia's bloody war on Yemen.
Unfortunately, Saudi money has weakened the role of the United Nations in Yemen and has changed the world body's political position. The United Nations' primary concern should be the humanitarian situation in Yemen, but it has failed to consider that.
In the message sent to Antonio Guterres on United Nations Day, Mashat called on the UN to stop manipulating the facts in Yemen for political ends. He said the world body has effectively covered up for Saudis during 7 years of war under blockade. He added that the UN failure to renew the mandate of the Human Rights Council's group of eminent experts is yet another proof of how Saudis are bribing their way through the world body.
It was not so much a message of congratulation as it was a message of blame for the UN's negative role regarding what the Yemeni people have been subjected to over the past 7 years. It's a clear message that the UN must play its role and that the international community has failed morally in Yemen. We are ready to support the continued work of the United Nations and its humanitarian organizations and facilitate their operations inside Yemen, but on the condition that the United Nations protects the Yemeni people and stops Saudi violations.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war on Yemen on March 2015. The war has killed tens of thousands of people, including women and the children, and has pushed the country to the brink of famine.
Yemenis say the United Nations continues to apply double standards when dealing with the ongoing Saudi crimes against millions of Yemenis. They believe that the Yemeni army's operations are legitimate as it is defending the sovereignty of Yemen, which is the only way forward to put an end to the humanitarian crisis in the country. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
They're small in number, but they have big voices resonating along the streets of Oldham, Manchester, calling for Israeli arms company Elbit Systems to be shut down. This is the Elbit site in Manchester, and the event here organized by several pro-Palestinian groups who accuse Elbit of providing Israel with predatory drones and other military hardware, accusing it of complicity in Israeli war crimes and in abetting Israel in terrorizing the people of Gaza. Elbit Systems UK, a subsidiary of the Israel-based company of the same name, employs over 500 people and has 10 sites in the UK. including four factories.
Israel is an apartheid state. It's a racist state which is preventing Palestinians from living their ordinary everyday lives. And indeed worse, it's starving them, it's bombing them, it's killing them, it's depriving them of their lands and homes. And it has been since 1948. This factory here, Elbit, is the largest private Israeli arms factory. There's 10 outlets in the UK, and they are all making drones and weapons which go to kill Palestinians.
Apart from supplying Israel with weaponry, Elbit is also a major supplier of sophisticated technology to the British military.
That Britain and Israel have a clear, incestuous, revolving door type of relationship between each of their military establishments and their arms companies. We are fighting back against that here.
In August, pro-Palestine activists took their fight to another level. Direct action against the same site in Oldham, causing disruption to the firm's operations. For their actions, they often face intimidation, arrest, and possible prison time. But they say they're unfazed. Events such as the one today have led to increased public awareness about Elbit and its operations and growing calls for its closure. That, the activists say, is one important step towards a free Palestine.
The United Nations has warned that more than half of Afghanistan's 39 million population is facing acute food insecurity as hunger is rising and children are dying. "We can't feed people on promises," says the head of the World Food Program, David Beasley. He has urged world countries to step up life-saving assistance to resuscitate Afghanistan's economy.
"We have been left on the streets for 3 months now. We haven't received any aid despite calls on the United Nations. Most women and children are sick or starving. Why are they doing this to us? Aren't we human beings?"
"Nowadays, there are no jobs for us, but there is poverty, hunger, and disaster. We are a family of 10 and wondering what to do and how to feed them. Winter is closing in and prices are rising. People will die if the government and other countries don't take any action."
Here, Afghan social activists have come together on behalf of millions of vulnerable people and families to protest the critical humanitarian situation in the country. They're calling on the U.S. to free Afghans' assets and compensate them for its war crimes in Afghanistan.
"We are chanting for our rights. The U.S. has always treated Afghans with cruelty. Our protest today has two aims. First, we are calling on the U.S. to free up our own money and let aid flow in. Second, the U.S. must compensate us for the war crimes it has committed and the damage it has caused."
The Taliban takeover weakened an already fragile economy that was heavily dependent on foreign aid. Western countries suspended aid, and the World Bank and International Monetary Fund also halted payments. Immediate global aid is now crucial to meet the most basic humanitarian needs of Afghans as winter approaches with no jobs, cash, or prospects for the people. Afghans and humanitarian bodies have warned of imminent disaster if proper action is not taken. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Iran is a land of ethnic diversity, and that is reflected in different languages, cultures, and of course, music. After over a one-year hiatus due to the coronavirus, the Iranian Folk Music Festival has once again hosted musicians from across Iran, each playing their local tunes using their indigenous instruments.
"I come from the northern Khorasan province. I am so happy to be part of this music festival, to share my city's music with my fellow Iranians from other cities. I have brought our local instruments, such as sorna, which is an ancient Iranian woodwind instrument, and dhol, which is a local type of drum.
We in Sistan and Baluchistan province play sitar, which we also call tambure. We also play qaychak, which is a type of a bowed lute, similar to kamanche. We usually play in celebrations."
Every night during the three-day festival, different local ensembles took to the stage to perform, so the audience could listen to Kurdish, Baluchi, Azeri, and Arabic tunes in a matter of a few hours. And this is my favorite part, On the sidelines of the festival, bands from different ethnicities get together and improvise. This is where music transcends languages and interconnects various cultures.
Music is a language that needs no translation. We may not understand each other's languages, but as you could see, different people are interacting peacefully through music.
It's so interesting to see artists from different parts of the country perform together. This is the true meaning of national unity that binds us despite our cultural differences.
And organizers say that's the main purpose of holding such an event, to unite different ethnicities through the language of music.
Music is an integral part of society's identity and history, and Iran is no exception. So the festival tries to both introduce the local music of different ethnic groups in Iran while establishing peace and friendship among them.
Organizers also hope that the festival would help revive Iran's folk music, which has long been overshadowed by some of the heavily invested genres, like pop.
Through music, it's easier to grasp the ethnic diversity in Iran, because music itself is a language, a universal language that speaks the beauty of differences and peaceful coexistence of different cultures as one nation. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Kerman.
The sanctions by the United Nations Security Council against North Korea over its nuclear and missile programs have been in place for more than a decade. The UN now acknowledges that the U.S.-backed sanctions were at least partly responsible for North Korea's food and medicine shortages.
DPR Korea has never been more isolated from the international community than at this point in time. This is having a dramatic impact on the human rights of the people inside of the country and dampens hopes of achieving sustainable peace and security on the Korean Peninsula.
The special rapporteur was echoing and backed the call by some member states for sanctions relief for North Korea.
There must be a move back towards the spirit of multilateral cooperation that enabled the foundation of the United Nations in the first place.
This weekend, the South Korean and U.S. envoys on North Korea met in Seoul, with South Korea calling for an official declaration to end the 1950-53 Korean War, and the U.S. agreeing to discuss the proposal later. The U.S. has often repeated that it's willing to meet with North Korea anywhere, anytime, without preconditions. U.S. officials have now added that the country holds no hostile intent toward North Korea, while at the same time pressing for stronger implementation of the controversial United Nations Security Council sanctions. South Koreans expressed their hope the international community could at least provide humanitarian aid.
The United Nations need to support North Koreans so that they don't continue to suffer from starvation.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in has sought to build peace with North Korea, arranging summits and proposing other avenues of engagement, while the U.S. maintained a hard line. President Moon will leave office next spring. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A Yemeni human rights group called the Eye of Humanity Center for Rights and Development has released a report on casualties caused by 6 years of Saudi-led war on Yemen. The report says more than 44,000 civilians have been killed or injured since 2015 when Riyadh launched an aggression against Sana'a. Thousands of women and children are among the victims, according to the report.
We released a report on the casualties of the Yemen war during the past 2,400 days of the conflict. 44,221 civilians were killed or injured, targeted by airstrikes and cluster bombs. More than 4,000 children and 2,800 women are among the victims who lost their lives.
Also, hundreds have been left with permanent disabilities, the report says. Thousands of civilian facilities were also targeted by the Saudi-led coalition's warplanes. Hospitals, schools and power stations were bombed across Yemen, affecting lives of millions of Yemenis in a country already hit hard by poverty.
The Saudi-led coalition has deliberately targeted civilian facilities to kill civilians. It did not differentiate between civilian and military targets. The coalition has violated international laws that ban military attacks on civilian facilities.
However, infrastructure are not the only civilian targets hit by Saudi and coalition warplanes. According to the report, more than 500,000 homes have been destroyed during the war. As a result, millions of Yemenis have been displaced across the country.
The ongoing Saudi war and the blockade imposed on Yemen is killing more Yemenis as it has deprived millions of civilians, including children, of their basic needs such as food and medicine. However, the international community remains silent regardless of the situation in Yemen, which the United Nations describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Human rights organizations warn that the long-term Israeli blockade has led to deterioration of water crisis in Gaza, making the enclave's water undrinkable. The organizations also said the crisis has led to poisoning of the residents of the besieged enclave. The situation was exacerbated by an acute electricity crisis that hampered the operation of water wells and sewage treatment plants, leading about 80% of Gaza's untreated sewage to be discharged into the sea, while 20% seeps into underground water.
We suffer from shortage of water. Sometimes we are without water for weeks. Meanwhile, the available water is very salty, polluted, and unfit for daily uses, especially in the refugee camps. Palestinians here are forced to buy mineral water for drinking, but only a few of them can afford having it.
Israel's attacks on Gaza last May have doubled the crisis, as the attacks pounded the enclave's already crumbling infrastructure. This presents a serious threat to the Gaza population's health, where recent data indicates that about a quarter of the diseases spreading Gaza are caused by water pollution, and a great number of deaths of young children and infants are linked to intestinal diseases related to polluted water.
Many children and elderly people are suffering from serious diseases due to the polluted water. Most of the families here go to hospitals on a weekly basis as they have kidney problems. We call on the International Human Rights Organization to support us.
The human rights groups also warn that the water crisis will lead to a catastrophe for the health system in the Gaza Strip, and called on the international community to pressurize Israel in order to guarantee Gazans' right to water security.
There are three centers for treating water in Gaza which need fuel. We can provide only 35% of the required amount of drinking water. The residents of Gaza cannot drink the water. Our underground water is also polluted and unfit for drinking, and most of the time we are forced to buy water.
Israel has deprived Palestinians of benefiting from the natural resources of water, which has led to a serious water security crisis in the Gaza Strip. The shortage of water is threatening the lives of 2 million Palestinians and has doubled the burden on the health system in the impoverished enclave. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Recent developments in Afghanistan have marginalized attention to coronavirus crisis in the country. In the meantime, officials and doctors at Kabul's Afghan Japan COVID-19 hospital say new money has been paid to the hospital, pushing it further towards a closure.
We have many problems as the cold season is approaching. We expect another wave of the virus in coming weeks. We ask our ex-donors to pay the salaries of the employees. We can't run the hospitals on our own. If their assistance is not resumed, the only COVID-19 hospital of Afghanistan will close.
Patients getting treatment in the hospital complain about insufficient medical supplies and care, urging the international bodies to save the hospital from closing and so the lives of Afghans.
My father has contracted the coronavirus. We are here for weeks. Everything seemed okay, but today we see that the hospital suffers from lack of oxygen and medicines. Meanwhile, the doctors have not been paid for months.
This comes as the U.S. insists on freezing nearly 9